Welcome to a mini-series of Neurosalience, featuring interviews with some of this year's annual meeting's keynote speakers. Today we have Dr. Aviv Meza. Dr. Meza is an associate professor at the Edmund and Lily Safra Center for Brain Scientists, or the ELSC, at Hebrew University in Jerusalem, Israel. Professor Meza did his graduate and undergraduate studies in the field of biochemistry at Tel Aviv University. After completing his undergraduate and graduate studies at Tel Aviv, Professor Meza moved to Stanford to work with Dr. Brian Wandel. Research in Dr. Meza's lab is focused on mapping human brain structures during normal development and aging. In addition, it is focused on developing new approaches to characterize the structural changes associated with neurological disorders. Meza's main research tool is in vivo quantitative MRI. The Meza Lab is developing tools to biophysically explain the brain's MRI signals at different levels and resolutions, from molecular local sources through cellular organization to the mapping of networks across the brain. I hope you enjoy the interview. And who's not familiar with any of your research, or someone who wants an introduction to what you do, can you describe broadly the main aims of what you do?
I'm trying to look on the microstructure of the human brain and try to see how it vary as function of age, particularly aging. So as brain change as we progress into older age, and the way we try to do it is using something called quantitative MRI, which is a tool to really first measure our brain with physical unit. And the most important thing for me is also to interpret the biology. So relate these physical values to something that actually happened in the tissue. And I find it very inspiring that we can actually look on those changes at the level of the individual brain and see what is vary as we age. Normal aging and in clinical cases in particular.
Excellent. So I'm going to come back to a few of those points that you've mentioned there. But first of all, I just would like to take a step back and just ask really, how was it that you became interested in this? How is it that you came to be working in this field?
The truth is, I guess like many other things, it was a little bit of a mistake or luck. My PhD is actually in a very different field. It was about exocytosis and modeling of that. And toward the end of my PhD, I felt like I actually want to acquire data and I really want to measure the brain, the human brain. And I was lucky that there was then a new researcher in the institute I was at. His name was Yaniv Asaf, which is a known researcher in MR. And I kind of joined his lab for a year or so. And I learned a lot, and that's how I entered this field without really knowing what I'm going to do. And then I progressed to the lab of Brian Wandel at Stanford, was sure that I'm going to do a fMRI. I was really excited to read about their work in a population receptive field. That was the front, and it was so exciting, and I was sure that that's what I'm going to do. And I did a little bit of that. But there was other people in the lab who were doing a quantitative MRI for white matter in order to learn about development. And I just couldn't understand what they're saying because it was close to the language that I knew for my PhD, like the biophysics, water interaction with surfaces, etc. I find it exciting. So, okay, maybe that's going to be my thing. And that's how I entered to this field. So I wouldn't say it was planned.
Fantastic. So looking through some of your papers, something I was particularly impressed by was how the focus on using clinically accessible scanners, so around sort of the order of 3 Tesla. Now, you know, 7 Tesla, 10 Tesla scanners, that work is phenomenal in its own way, and it's all very futuristic, and the images are amazing, and it's great. But there's always this gap then between the results that come out of that and how you could translate that to a clinic in any short time frame. So I appreciate that element of your work. Now, in that context, what do you see as the role of quantitative MRI in clinics, either now or in, you know, 5, 10, even 20 years time? And what do you feel is holding it back from being a sort of widely clinically available tool? Or, you know, should we be using it already?
Well, of course, I would say that we should. But if, and I think we would, as well. And I, as you said, I particularly interested in work that can be translatable, that it can actually make a difference on the life of people in the close future. And not on, I mean, I agree. There's a lot of, there's important in creating the future or the new tools that will be used in the farther future. But I find it particularly interesting and exciting to do things that have like the potential to be translated soon. And that's what I'm trying to do in my work. And I think QMRI, so this field, have, I guess, two limitation currently, maybe three. The first one is just we don't use, it's not part of the practice. So just to make change the practice, change the what clinicians are used to do to use for their clinic, just take times. And particularly the, it will be faster if we will find a really clear need or clear application that would show that they really need it. And I think we are getting closer there. We have our own work about Parkinson, which I actually feel that that might be something that can actually be used in the clinic soon. The other thing is time. You just take time, right? QMRI in the current way, if you wanted to have it in a reasonable resolution, it's at least 10 minutes. And that's a limitation, particularly in the clinical setup. It costs money, the it's hard for the patients, etc. And I think the interesting thing that happens right now is that engineers really push a new method like fingerprinting and others to make it faster. And I think they are almost ready. I think in a few years, all of us will use it, and then there won't be a question anymore. QMRI will be something that everyone's do, even if it doesn't have any added value, and I'm sure it will have added value. It will be so fast that we will do it anyway. That will be the normal. That will be like our T1 weighted
You
for
might
now.
as well do it because it's there and it's accessible and
Yeah,
then.
and easy and cheap essentially. So I think the what happens with the vendors that that adopting the new discoveries of the engineers will actually going to make the difference.
Because the vendors at the moment they're very clear about, I think it Nicholas Stickov always makes the point of mentioning
Yes.
they're not measurement devices is what they say. That's what the vendors say. But now we seem to be getting towards the point where actually, potentially they might be.
So they have also a question of legal. There is also a legal question there, right? They if they will say that, then they have to support something which they're not certain they have. And they actually currently there is also no request from the clinicians. But has it become easier and simpler, and it will be used all over in the clinic whenever someone or all over in research first, whenever do some someone will do something, you will do it because it will be easy and fast. Exactly as T1 weighted. Then we'll start to see more and more application, more and more need and use, and then they will have to adopt. Then it will be like a thermometer. I mean, we cannot imagine that we'll use a thermometer without units, and that will be also true for MRI. And I'm actually pretty sure that it will come also with the new knowledge about the brain biology. So I think there is a great potential there.
So then, what do you think is the potential of QMRI in terms of helping us to move away from group level assessment of patient groups and move more towards assessing individual variation in people? And how important do you feel that that goal really is?
I think it's the most important. Why would we do group analysis? It could be because the signal is not strong enough and we just have to in order to see something. So the difference that we can measure between a group and the other group is that it's small and noisy in a way that we just have to use this group analysis. Or because there is so many other sources that intervene in our measurement, and then kind of to average them out, we will use the group. We'll hope that everything which is not important will be averaged out and we'll stay with the effect that we interesting, that is interesting about the two different groups. But as we use measurement which have units and we try to remove all the other sources and try to account for them as much as we can, but we account for them more and more and be and getting better and better in that. Of course, it's not perfect yet, and I guess it will never be perfect, but it should get to a level, and we're getting there to the level that we can trust it enough that we can actually look on variability between subjects, and this variability become meaningful. And that's open a new era actually of brain research and for structure measurement. That's actually already happened in many ways for diffusion, and I think it's now going to happen also for other. Well, diffusion is kind of quantitative measurement, and will happen for the other quantitative measurement as well, and it's happening. So I think we are about to be there. And actually, I think people are appreciating that. You can see more and more research when people using different type of quantitative measurement in the research, and they will look on variability between individual, which is of course the most interesting aspect of working with humans. And again, that will be, I believe that will be adopted and will be part of our common practice soon.
Yeah, I wanted to speak about one of your papers. It's actually your most highly cited paper is a 2014 paper in Nature Communications with Jason Neatman and Brian Wandel, in which you describe all of you describe the maturation and degradation of white matter across the lifespan. Yeah, you highlight how the rate of tract maturation is equal to the rate of tract degradation. It's sort of this symmetrical U-shaped or inverted U-shaped curve. So it was just a thought that occurred to me. You know, what if the rate of degradation is sort of set at maturation, what does that mean for one's ability to actually modify that trajectory? Is that fixed, or is that still something that can be changed through lifestyle choices or otherwise?
The answer is, of course, I don't know. And this research is a cross-section research, right? We measure subject in different ages. And it didn't have to be that it will look like a parabola in the sense that the rate in which values will increase and the rate that they will decrease will be the same. And I just want to say that this work was replicated already several times. So when we saw that, we said, oh, that's what we see. And there's something intriguing about it, why the rate of development will go with the rate of whatever it is, a degradation or aging. And I still don't know what is going on there. And the thing I'm actually pretty certain about is that it's not the same process. It's not the same process that happened in development and degradation. It's not that the same thing that is built are removed, right? So our measurement in that case, it was R1, is sensitive for multiple things, right? And it's happened to look like this parabola. And I think it's a wonderful question why. Actually, having a quantitative measurement allow us to see that. And then question like the one you just asked, we can ask them. So I don't have the answer actually, but I think the fact that we have the ability to ask the question is progress. The answer is that I don't know, and I don't know if we are plastic, right? The question was also, are we plastic in the sense that if we do something, would it change the graph? It might. I don't know. It is actually, again, when we have a measurement, we can actually do now the intervention, something like that, and actually look for it and see. And maybe have some recommendation for the future for someone. There is something about the environment that will affect you or not. Maybe it's all genetics. Having a way to measure it is key for any kind of conclusion in the future.
There's a lot of talk increasingly nowadays about, you know, we have an awful lot of data collected in young people and an awful lot of data collected in older people, you know, 60 years plus. And there's this gap in the middle where actually there's not nearly as many studies studying people aged 40 to 50 and that middle age. Do you think we need to be focusing on that more in order to understand this trajectory better? Or do you think these better tools might be sufficient with the data sets that we've got?
I think it's a very interesting question. So what happened here is I guess we also measure or like to focus on the things that actually vary. And there is a big variation in development, and there is a big variation in aging. And in this middle age, as a researcher, it's kind of flat. So maybe the focus is kind of like moved away because we're also driven by our data. And maybe the data is not very compelling at least in the first look.
But is it flat then because the measures that we've been using appear flat across there, or are the new?
Right. Are very sensitive to those changes that happen in, I guess also in terms of microstructure, there is a big changes that happen in development and aging. There's like key big changes that happen across individual that are trackable, that you can track them. And it's important. We kind of like, okay, so we define them. Now we're gonna get to the interesting stuff, which is we will remove or will account for this age effect. Then what is all the other variability we just don't know to account for right now? I guess there is the interesting things happen there. And I will go back to your question and talk about Parkinson. In Parkinson, for instance, so we were very happy last year. We were able to see a change in Parkinson microstructure in MRI. So that was a new, great. Until now, it wasn't possible, and now we can see it. But then, so we were excited, and then we understand that the interesting thing that happened in Parkinson actually probably happens 20 years before. So when you see this degradation, it's when the disease started, and it seems, or what we know now from reading the literature, that the disease probably started 10 or 20 years before, and those patients probably were accumulating damage until they go to the level when it start to affect their motor skills, for instance. That's how they first diagnosed. So I think this is actually very interesting to go back and ask if we can track the sources or see the early changes that maybe didn't generate yet the motor disability in the case of Parkinson. And that's something we try to do. And of course, not only us. So yes, there is a value to go back and ask what happened in this age when things seem either flat in terms of changes in function of age, and there is more variability which we don't know to account. And probably this is the interesting variability.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Even if it's reduced, there's that those differences might be what are really important in predicting someone's future trajectory, perhaps, if you have the right.
It's a hard research, but we're getting to the stage when we understand that that's where we should look at.
Yeah, and it goes back to the same thing of with quantitative MRI. You can reduce that noise and reduce the variability that we're not interested in, and really get to decoding that interesting variability.
And you can actually try to relate to biology. I think that's it. So there are two key things here. One, we reduce the non-interesting variability and stay with something which actually assume we understand and it can quantify. And then we can actually go to the biology. We can ask, okay, what are the different sources? What might change, right? There's this discussion about myelin and iron, but I think there's actually much more that we can actually tease apart from quantitative MRI, and that will be wonderful. This idea of in vivo histology will actually have a lot of future.
Well, you've actually perfectly segued into my next question there, which is wonderful. A lot of your work, especially your recent work, you do address this question of what is the biology that is driving these signals. And people often refer to magnetization transfer measures as analogs of myelin, and it does correlate very, very strongly with myelin, particularly in white matter. But so do you feel that that simplification is suitable, particularly either in healthy people and in particular tissues, or do you think it's less suitable in different cases? And are there other macromolecules that are significantly affecting this that might be of interest in Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, or other disease groups, perhaps?
Right. So the idea that MR, like MT measurement, but also others, are measurement of myelin is simplification. It is wrong per se. It's not true that it's myelin, but it's very useful simplification and model. So like many other models, it's a wrong but very useful model. From my perspective, and actually the way I entered quantitative MRI, it was using a measure, the most boring measurement, which is proton density, just measuring the amount of in the brain, it's the amount of water. And I say the most boring, but I also think it's the most interesting, because actually all our quantitative measurements are heavily weighted by the amount of water. And the reason many quantitative measurements look like myelin, I would say it is because when you have more myelin, you have less water. The main effect is just how much water you got there, like how much what is actually driving the signal. So accounting for it is important. It's of course the main effect, so it's interesting, and we should try to model it, and it goes with myelin in the white matter, as you said, etc. I'm not ignoring it. It is the main effect of many quantitative measurements like MT. But there is actually much more information there than that. So knowing that measuring, say, MT in another measurement, like water fraction, which actually allow us to say what is the aspect that comes from water fraction and what is the aspect that comes from something else, like the type of macromolecules. So it's true, myelin is the most dominant one for sure in healthy white matter, but also even myelin is not one thing. Like it's many type of macromolecule, many type of lipid and proteins, and we have work that show that the different types actually have different effect. And actually, we have a work about that, but we follow work that was done in the 90s in Canada from Hankenmann lab. It was doing in NMR. And Koenig, even earlier, the type of phospholipid actually changed the MR signal. So It's actually hard to separate between the type of macromolecules, proteins or lipid, and the amount of them. But having two measurements, you can measure the amount, try to account for it, and then look on the other aspect, which is the type of macromolecules. And for me, this is a way to learn about the biology and get more information. So say again and again that things are myelin, it's great, but I think there is more.
Yeah, but also in that field, then you know, we with quantitative MRI, it's always that question of what is it, what is the signal that's driving that, what is causing it, and we can try and verify that using histology, right? Postmortem. The obvious difference between those is that the tissue composition, particularly you know the water, as you say, that's what's really driving the signal, but that's going to be very different in an in vivo living human brain that's still being used by its owner versus someone that's been fixed and sliced and stained. So do you, to what extent do you feel that those are comparable? And there are going to be differences like the vasculature, like the microvasculature and the mesovasculature that are going to be completely different in a healthy or in a living brain than in ex vivo. So how do you think those comparisons influenced by those sorts of things, and are they comparable?
I would say a few things about histology in general. From many times we use histology as the gold standard, right? We measure in vivo, but we're looking for gold standard. From my experience and experience of when I talk with my colleagues, many of them actually notice that sometimes we are more exact than the histological work. So it's like maybe it sounds that I'm not humble when I'm saying that, but there's something about us very careful about how we measure and try to get the units right and really careful about the interpretation, which you not always find in the histological work. So it's true that it's a physical gold standard, but sometimes it's not 100% reliable, I would say, and accurate as some of the quantitative measurement that we try to use in the human brain. On the other hand, it's not that we have a very good other option besides comparing our measurement to histology. I will share two ideas that we have in the lab, and I find them useful and adding to the regular histological validation. One of them is using phantoms. We can think about histology is kind of like top down. We have a tissue and try to we separate what there was there and say how much can we relate it to the signal that we had, right? Like the how much our signal in MR was related to the amount of myelin that we measure in the tissue. But you can do it in the other direction, right? You can actually build tissue if you want, combine macromolecules or whatever you think is actually derived the signal, iron forms, proteins, aggregate of proteins, et cetera, put them in different concentration and different ratios and see how they affect the MR. So that give us another handle to learn about what drive our signal. Of course, this is also not perfect because it's we would never be able to generate the complexity of biological tissue, but it's another way to separate the sources, and I find it very useful. And another thing which I particularly excited about is measuring in vivo in the same subject that I'm doing the histology on, and we found this like interesting correlation with neurosurgeons. So I invite people to do that. I think it's actually interesting. Neurosurgeons are the people who actually scan before the surgery and resect the tissue. And it's the same tissue. So what we do, we're working with neurosurgeon working on brain cancers. And there we can actually scan the patient in vivo, alive, everything is intact. And then they remove the tissue because it's part of the practice, right? And then we have tissue that we can actually relate to a measurement in vivo. It overcomes, it's one of the obstacles that you mentioned, which is what happens when we scan, say, ex vivo. Many things change. And in this case, we actually scan in vivo. Of course, also have limitation. You cannot do it everywhere and not for everyone, of course, et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's a very valuable source to validate our measurement as well. So, and also have, it might have a clinical outcome, right? Because you might also help those patients like those, because it's not that the diagnostic in brain cancer is perfect. Frankly.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, if you can then assess it once it's removed with some sort of more advanced assessment protocol, then yeah, you could provide that more information to the patient.
And I didn't answer your blood vessel because I actually don't know the answer. It's definitely affecting it, changing a disease. Clear that many of the, say, neurodegenerative diseases have an effect on blood vessels. And
Right.
I don't, I feel that we are actually not, I'm not very good in assessing that in my research. Like a little bit of a black hole because it just, maybe we don't have the right tools. We try now to create a new way to measure iron environment, not iron amount, but iron environment. And that might be actually also sensitive to blood vessel, but it's not like I have the answer yet.
And would that be sensitive to different, say, iron, iron in microglia versus iron in red blood cells and
It might ferritin, transferrin, and different type of environment of iron. So we're definitely getting more information about the iron environment. If it will answer the question that you ask, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that we're moving forwards and hopefully encroaching on the answers to these questions. Taking a step back from that, where do you see this going? This either the field as a whole or your work specifically. Where would you like to see it in maybe 5 years or 10 years?
So we're going to get much more data because everything's going to be fast and this data will be richer. As the scan becomes shorter, we actually can add more and more element to the scans. And I think we're not going to stay with a single model of relaxation or whatever it is that we are doing. Each one is he do MT and I'm doing R1, and each one doing one thing. Going to be some kind of a multi-parametric measurement. The level of the biology that we're gonna retrieve from that will be much higher. So it's gonna be like many type of stains happening at the same time. So it's actually using the MR in a beautiful way because MR is always this method that allow us to be sensitive to so many. We have different contrast, right? It means that we have different relaxation mechanism there, essentially access to multiple biological variants or variability in the tissue and I think we're going to master that, or we'll be much better at that. That will be also, again, function of time. As things become faster, we can actually aggregate a lot of data, make sense of how we separate the different element and the picture, the histopathological measurement will be much richer. So yeah, that's where I think we are going. And that will probably, hopefully, will become part of clinical use because of that.
So then, taking a step back then further from the research specifically, I just want to ask really just a couple of questions about you as an academic and as a mentor specifically. How would you describe your mentorship style, and how was it that you settled into that role, that weird transition from going from PhD, postdoc to suddenly becoming an independent researcher? How, because I'm looking forward to this in the next few years now. It's a kind of a scary change, but how was it for you in that transition?
It's interesting, right? It's this thing that nobody trains you, and you just suddenly become this PI. And I think it's a combination of I'm trying to be really present. Actually, I learned it from my postdoc advisor, Brian Wendell, and he was always there. And he knew what we are doing. But also we had a lot of freedom. And when I was about to start my position, he told me, Aviv, whenever you, at least once a week, you should go to with your student for coffee. And even if it's only for 15 minutes, you should actually be really focused on what the obstacle that he's currently having in his like very small problem that he's now experienced. And having this level of mentorship or interaction will allow the student not to feel that they are on their own in this level that can be sometimes actually stressful and lonely. So in one hand, really be there for them and be interesting in their daily problems as small as they might be. I think so. In one hand, I'm kind of like I'm present, or I think in the other hand, I'm kind of like I sometimes let go, particularly in writing. I actually like to let my student write, and it actually become a very. It I think it's allow them to progress, and really be independent. I think it's from a problem that I have with myself. I will tell you something. I'm dyslexic, very. And so that's could be some of my insecurity, which I kind of felt like, okay, so I actually need you to step in and be very present in that. And I think it gave my student a lot of freedom and a lot of sense of power and ability. And that was for my benefit. It's really helpful. I think we publish a lot thanks to that, or publish more thanks for their sense that they can, and they can actually push things. And also it make them more independent and stronger as they continue to their next steps.
For early career researchers coming into this field, you mentioned that you came into this from a very sort of biological background, which actually, you can see this in your papers. You can see this. That's the importance of getting the what is the biological meaning of all these measures. But there's also the argument for people coming at it from a physics perspective, as in you almost come at it from the side of MRI and you say, well, what can we measure with these physical measures? Is there any particular training that you think is more useful for people who are just coming into this field, like looking at the field in the future and saying, what do you think what would be most useful? Or do you think it's a sort of case of being trained a little bit in everything and trying to learn how to communicate with both sides or that sort of area in between?
The answer is, of course, everything, right? I think the most important thing is being creative and open-minded. But if there's something that I feel like I always lacking, and I always feel a little bit, I wouldn't say sad, but as a young student, I was considering going to physics or not. I was studying. I started what I learned in my bachelor was biology and chemistry. So I had a physics in the sense of chemistry, but not as a physicist. And is always the thing. I was considering moving to physics, and I didn't. If there is a knowledge that I would like to have in more organized and like kind of like, so you learn the physics along the way, but it's not the same as learning it from scratch. And I think it's the core of everything. So I would keep my physics, or I would go. If I were me 20 years ago, I would actually join the physics courses. Back then.
Well, no doubt you've valued from the other, you've benefited from the other side of that and having that biological background as well. So you're right. I think it's yeah, I totally agree. It's yeah, to have an appreciation of both is super valuable. But just to wrap up then, final thing that we're very excited to have you at OHBM this year. But what is without spoiling too much, if you want to keep it a secret, that's fine too. But what do you think is going to be the sort of focus of your talk this year?
So I have to decide what I'm going to do exactly. But currently, my plan is to try to show how combined multiple quantitative measurement actually give us additional information, kind of moving from this idea of myelin and iron to the molecular environment that we sense with water. So I think this is important and not appreciated enough yet. And so I think I would like to highlight that.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. And yeah, like I said, we're certainly looking forward to your talk in Montreal this year.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. Thank you.